From Welcome Villain Films, the studio that brought you the horror hit Malum, as well as Beaten to Death and Hunter Killer, comes their newest nightmare, Mind, Body, Spirit, now available on digital. Directed by Alex Haynes and Matthew Miranda, and produced by Dan Asma, Mind, Body, Spirit follows Anya, an aspiring yoga influencer, as she embarks on a ritual practice left behind by her estranged grandmother. What starts as a spiritual self-help guide quickly evolves into something much more sinister, as Anya becomes increasingly obsessed with the mysterious power of the practice. She unwittingly unleashes an otherworldly entity that begins to take control of her life and her videos. Now, Anya must race to unlock the truth before her descent into madness threatens to consume her mind, body, and spirit. During its festival tour, with stops at Chattanooga Film Festival and the Unnamed Footage Festival, Mind, Body, Spirit garnered praise from critics who call it a found footage version of Hereditary and a knockout found footage horror movie for the live stream era. Experience the first ever yoga-themed found footage horror film, and don't miss the film viewers have called extremely frightening and upsetting. Available now on digital anywhere you rent or buy movies online, including Prime Video and Apple Plus.
And welcome back to Scarred for Life, the podcast where we open up old wounds by looking back at the films that scared us as kids. I'm Terry.
And I'm Mary Beth.
And each episode, our special guest brings with them a movie that traumatized them as a child.
Very exciting. This week our guest is Purpurina. You have seen their horror cross stitch on social media, but they're also the producer of Observable Radio, a found footage anthology podcast of retro sci-fi and analog horror, aka all my favorite things. Welcome to the show!
Hi! Thank you guys for having me. I am absurdly excited for this conversation.
I am also absurdly excited for this conversation.
I cannot wait to dig into the movie you brought with you today, but let's start at the beginning. For those that might not have known about Observable Radio, can you kind of give us the idea of what this podcast is?
Yeah, Mary Beth hit the log line. Our first season centers around our wraparound character, the Observer, who's been receiving some strange signals that seem to come from universes different than our own. Every episode gives us a glimpse of one of these worlds, and the Observer tries to make sense of what he's hearing as much as he can.
So cool. I've listened to the first two episodes, and the first one, I gotta admit, I was like, I don't know what is going on here, because it was like a lot of little bits. But when I got to the second episode, I was like, ooh, this is really interesting. The one, it's about cattle drive, and I'm not going to spoil what happens in it. But I love this conceit about this kind of wraparound, well, anthology, but then also like telling a kind of a little bit of short stories in between. It's really kind of cool. How did you get involved with this?
Cameron, who created the Observable Radio, is his very much baby. It came from him. He brought on his high school friend, Phil Van Hest, who is the Observer, shortly after. And then Cameron and I have been talking about it ever since when he thought of it. We became friends because our opinions on horror are basically one-to-one. Okay. We bonded very much on liking and disliking the same things. So from the jump, when he first came up with it, we've kind of been talking about it, and I was sort of brought in. And we do need to give a shout out to one of your former guests. A big part of the inspiration came from Skinamarink. Cameron saw Skinamarink. Yeah, absolutely. And he was like, look, I want to make this thing where we give snippets, tastes of information, and we make the audience kind of put it together themselves, figure it out. It's been a lot of fun trying to do that in an audio medium where we need to give more information than Skinamarink does in an audio space, a little bit more, but still kind of, where do we need to pull back? Where do we actually need to give a little bit more information? It's been really fun kind of playing with that push and pull.
So a lot of us know you from cross-stitching online, which is so fucking cool. So have you always had an interest in kind of producing audio, writing short stories, writing horror fiction? Like, how did you kind of bridge the gap, as it were?
Yeah, that's a good, like, I've always liked writing. At the risk of tooting my own horn, it came somewhat easy to me in terms of, like, school writing assignments. I would very easily kind of spit something out and turn it in.
I think I'm going to go out on a limb and say that all three of us were probably like that growing up.
Yeah, like, just figure that, like, here you go, here's something, you know, kind of off the wall, whatever. And so that was always encouraged as well by teachers and parents and stuff. Audio, completely new to me. Like, that was 100% a...
Cool.
Cameron did another podcast when the Willow TV show was on, about the Willow TV show.
Rip, seriously, for real.
Rip. I mean, I wanted to see where they were going in season two, but that's another podcast. So he got some experience kind of cutting and editing things together and found that he really liked it. So he was already drawn to that podcast space. I will admit, I'm still a baby whenever he tells me, like, we need to do this. I go, you need to explain, like, I'm five. I don't know what those words are. But yeah, like, I've been helping a lot more with kind of story writing, outreach kind of stuff. And it's been really fun to kind of learn as we go along as well. Cool. with every facet.
Well, I mean, like, that's the best way to learn this stuff. Like, there probably is, but, like, there was no audio, like, big audio podcast engineering. Like, yeah, there's audio engineering, but that's, like, high level, not just, like, producing podcast engineering. And so, like, the best way to learn is just doing it with someone who knows how to do it. Terry literally Googled things and then on a phone call, he gave me, like, the numbers to input into Audacity and, like, the best levels and stuff for... I've used those same numbers for years. I will never touch them.
I was Terry YouTubing, I was Googling, I was doing anything I possibly could and then being like, okay, this sounds okay, let's use this. This is what we're going to do. And then don't change anything. It's a different language.
For sure. Even just on the recording side of things, I've done a couple of voices. There's one episode where there's creatures, I'll say, moaning in the background. And for me, it was a lot to even figure out how to record those kind of noises without blowing out the microphone. It's been a very fun educational journey.
So is this a podcast people need to listen to chronologically, or can they listen out of order? What's the best way for people to listen?
I think the first few episodes they could do out of order, but long term, given Observer's story, you're definitely going to want to get that chronologically.
Cool.
And it's funny that you mention Cattle Drive, Terry, because that's always the one, the reveal in that one, people are always like, holy shit, you guys. Like, that's always the one.
I was listening to it and I was like, okay, there has to be something here. Are we going to go back to this whole story? And I was like, I think I know kind of where it's going, but the how and what ends up happening, still like, oh shit. Like, that is where I got hooked. And so I've downloaded them all and I'm going to be continuing to listen to them. Is this going to be done in, like, seasons, or how is the release going to be planned out? Do you know?
So the first season is Observer's story. We're playing with the idea of doing different things. We're kind of going, like, we have a lot of different ideas for other things, but let's finish the first season before we commit to anything. We release once a month because also all of us are balancing day jobs in addition to this.
Well, and it's very produced. There's a lot of, like, it's not just a podcast of people talking. There's a lot of sound effects. There's a lot of cutting into different things. Like, it is definitely, it feels like an audio drama in that way.
I was gonna say, it's not just like us editing some audio levels and getting ums and ahs out. Like, it's a full-on, like, you're making a movie for your ears. That's the dumbest thing I've ever said.
No, anyway. but it's real though. Like, there was one scene that we were trying, Cameron and I were just going back and forth, we're like, something is off, and we're like, oh, we need this audio cue because we can picture it, but just listening to it, you can't. Like, it really is, like, translating it.
What a cool skill, and, like, what a cool thing to learn. Like, that kind of storytelling format. It's just like, that's neato. That's just
it's
neat.
So different, because especially I'm a very visual person in how I learn. And even if you look at my short stories, I describe certain things, trying to get the reader to picture it. Like, and so we can do that to a degree in this kind of audio. Like, if it was the kind where we're reading a short story, okay, we can include those details. But, like, we're like, okay, I know this person goes from here to here and does this and that. How do I let someone hear that?
Right.
And really, a lot of the value I've gotten is just the... Sorry, my cat just went in the background and everybody reacted.
We love kitties here.
He's behaving today. He's being a little less mischievous. But just having this back and forth collaboration, I think also with Cameron and Phil has been really fun. Just that, like, oh, look, you know, like, well, we need this, or, well, the music, we thought it would work there, but let's take it out, actually. Okay, yeah, that's much better. Just having that space to work together is very different. Like, any other thing I've done, writing, stitching, whatever else, is a solo project.
Right. Yeah, I was going to say, you do a lot of solo stuff, so it's so cool to be able to collaborate and, like, stretch those muscles, those creative
muscles.
For sure.
For sure.
So what is your relationship to analog horror and found footage? Like, are you a big fan of the subgenres? Are you newer to them? I kind of know the answer to this, but I'm going to pretend like I don't for the podcast.
So kind of going back to Cameron and I first bonding, it was literally like, you like found footage too? That was, like, a big part of, like, that.
Good
way. Great. we're not the only ones. Because this was back 2016-ish when, like, fewer people were out loud. Like, it was still, oh, you know, those bad found footage movies was still the overarching discussion.
Yeah.
So let's go back to the start. How did you get introduced to the horror genre?
So I think it's just been ever present in my life.
Okay.
I'm going to, you know, if we're playing the Scarred for Life drinking game, raised Catholic.
Ding.
Mexican American family. There's especially Catholicism in Mexican American culture. I feel like there's a lot of interaction with horror.
It's no fucking joke, my dude. It is no joke.
I was talking about with my dad. I was telling him I'm going to be on this show. And, like, you take us little kids to a big room, you know, once a week where a man talks at us about sin and we got to stare at this dying man at the front of the, like, a statue of the dying man. Like, it's gnarly.
And then you drink his blood and eat his body and you just, like, go about your day. Like, it's just, like, a normal part of my week to eat a man.
And then we all go to Whataburger. It's fine.
Yeah, like, exactly. All right, cool. Let's go get fast food afterward and, like, go home and, like, watch
cartoons.
Christ
is not very filling today. Let's go to Whataburger.
For real. I got to get me some of those fries and the giant ass cup. Like,
we have to give a lot of flesh out so you can only give so much. That always freaked me out. What the fuck? I was like, what do you mean the body of Christ? Like, it's one dude. I don't understand. Like, I could not... It never freaked me out because I was like, logistically, that's impossible. So I was just like, I was like, there's no fucking way that that is a man's body.
Christ is the blob.
Well, I didn't even know until I was an adult that Catholics were supposed to believe in, what is it, transmutation, where, like, they believe that the blessing literally turns it into the body and blood.
Oh. Yeah, and that was, that's so dumb. No, sorry, I'm sorry. Like, oh, God.
Not, I mean, no
Catholic
longer
guilt
practicing.
Runs strong in Mary Beth.
But, like, well, I also, my dad's an engineer. My mom is a physician assistant, medical professional. And so we did our, like, first communion. And then, like, she'd be like, great, you did the sacrament. I personally don't drink from the wine because everybody's drinking from that cup. You don't need to do that. Like, just, like, very, like... As much as we were in that, it was also measured, which I'm very grateful for.
You didn't have, like, you didn't have, like, a super devout family. It was...
Not my nuclear family. I'll say it that way.
Yeah. That's what I meant. That is what I meant. not devout, yeah. like, parents. They weren't as intense about right. it.
Even then, I look back on it, because, like, I grew up in San Antonio, Texas, so... I'm sure everybody listening got a picture of what that political religious landscape might look like. But our church, especially when I was a teenager, was relatively liberal. Like, we would have like co-ed sleepovers at the church. We would, like, the youth program, they had people come in and talk to us about drugs. Like, people who were in active recovery talking about, this is what led me there. This is why, you know, like, I made some changes. Right. Like, it was, like,
okay,
really good. Like, especially, you know, like, so I was a teenager in the early aughts, right? So, like, at that time, at that place, weirdly okay messaging for the most part.
right.
And still, Catholicism brought upon what it still brings upon, no matter how progressive and liberal you may try to be.
No, for real. And I mean, we're going to touch on that piece a little bit later, but like, the other piece I think that kind of kept horror in my life, my dad denies being a horror fan for some reason, even though we were watching things like Predator with him, and like, he'll be like, no, that's sci-fi. And I'm like, Dad, the Venn diagram between horror and sci-fi is almost a circle. Like, there's no, in this last conversation I had with him, he goes, so the fly is horror? And I was like,
Yes, Dad. It's so funny. It's so funny how some people are very like, this is sci-fi, this is horror, and they can't
overlap.
Never
the two shall meet.
Mm-hmm. Right. Because like, there's a lot of people, one of the big things is, oh, I don't like horror. And I'm like, oh, okay. And then they'll talk about a movie and I'm like, you know, that's horror, right? And like, no, that's sci-fi, or that's this other thing that is not horror. And I'm like, yeah, the thriller, the whole thriller conversation. Don't even. But like, it's so funny how people are like, oh, I don't like horror, but I do like The Predator, and I like Alien, and I like Aliens, and I like...
I love Predator. I love people like, Predator's not a horror movie. I'm like...
It is about an alien that skins people and tears their...
He pulls a man's skull and spine out of his body with his bare, weird hands. It's an alien.
Arnold is a final girl in Predator.
Yes!
Like...
Final himbo.
Yes. Yeah. Like, yeah. No. And even my dad is a Stephen King fan. He's like read a bunch of his books.
Okay.
He, in fact.
Oh, okay. So here's the thing. Your dad's being a snob. And I say,
with all the respect.
With all the respect. Like, if that is like classic someone being like, well, I think horror is this one thing, and not understanding like the scope of horror, because I think especially when a lot of people grew up like our parents' ages, horror was like the slashers and shit.
The slashers
like
what comes up a whole lot.
Yeah.
Or like the idea of like the dead teenager movie where it's like tits and ass and sex and some mass killer killing people.
And they're like, that's like, not that is what people I think like. Of. Yeah.
100%. Yeah. And calling back to another one of your episodes, the anniversary one where you had people call in, I was at the time anonymous caller talking about It and my grandmother's clowns. And so
yes,
that was the one that, like, I'm over clowns as a fear now, but that was stuck around for a minute.
So do you remember what your first horror movie was?
Probably that one. And I also remember my mom showing me the Thriller music video, which I really liked it all the way up until what scared me was at the end when he turns around with the yellow eyes and the Vincent Price laugh. That was the part that I went, oh, that I can deal with the dancing zombies. Everything else, that part is too much.
It's been so long since I've seen the Thriller thing, because I used to have a VHS that was like a bunch of short films that were like released for his thing. And I think it was around the time of like I think it was called Moonwalker. I think they made a video game out of it. I don't remember, but there was a bunch. And I do remember the Thriller one because it started with like him and his girlfriend at the movies, and it eventually turns into a werewolf, I think. Am I remembering that correctly?
There's like the werewolf movie. They're watching a werewolf movie, but then he like turns into a zombie. It's
yeah. Yes.
as I'm saying it out loud, I'm like, that's not cohesive, but I still respect it.
So were you a scared kid?
So there were certain things that scared me. Like, we used to have like a Chuck E. Cheese kind of knockoff called Jungle Gyms, where there was like a gorilla, like a person in a gorilla mascot suit. That I can remember like my mom holding me and me like burying my face in her neck and her hair to be like, no, I'm not a fan of that guy. But like a lot of movies I really, or like TV shows, like didn't always bother me as much. Books, I remember being in kindergarten looking, because I couldn't read it yet, I was looking at the pictures in Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. Just fascinated. Like, the Harold picture scared me to the point that I tried not to touch the picture whenever I was holding the book.
But, like, I have a blanket with Harold on it, on my bed. Oh, and my family was like, why the fuck do you want that on your bed? And I was like, it's Harold. And they were like, you're crazy. And it was so funny because I loved that shit as a kid. I was like, hell yeah. And I was like, but I know what you mean about, like, they did feel, it felt like I shouldn't be allowed to read them.
Haunted. The one that always jumps out to me is the, I believe it is the girl that gets trapped in the trunk. Chest. Yeah. And there's like a shot of her body there with like webs next to it, her mouth. And she's like,
oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's right. Like, hello, that's a children's book, baby.
Yeah. That's the image that whenever I think of a scary story, that is what immediately comes into my head is that image.
I want to do an embroidery of, I forget the name of the story, but it's the one where she has like the string. It's a close up of her face, the stringy hair. She's like very skeletal. She has no eyes, like kind of like.
I just sent it in the chat. Is that the one you're talking about?
Let's find out. Yep. That's the one. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's the other image that comes to mind, too.
I want a tattoo of her so bad. Isn't that foul?
That's amazing.
I want a tattoo of her so bad. Like, I'm obsessed with her. Like, I'm obsessed with her. Like, these were the books, not to hijack, this is me, but, like, these were the books I would read and get so scared of, but always go back. Like, I dare myself to look at them again and, like, stare in her eyes. I was a weird kid, but, like...
It's because the art.
The art, man. I was, like, 5, and I was like, oh, my God.
No, I fully agree. And, like, you know, I was at the perfect age when Goosebumps was a thing. So, I remember Goosebumps were, like, my first chapter books that I finished by myself. Like, kind of, you know. And, yeah, just I don't want to be, like, I'm a horror fan because of my ADHD. But just kind of, like, the encompassing many facets that contribute. So with ADHD, we're understimulated. And I think with horror and fear, like, there is this stimulation that becomes fun, because I think it's also safe to engage in a book or a movie or a TV show. Like, there's an end point. There's, you know, you can turn the TV off. You can close the book. And when you're already understimulated as a kid and then you have that stimulation, it's like, whoa, that was a lot of neurochemicals. That felt good. I'm going to do it again.
That makes sense.
Okay, so before we talk about your Scarred for Life pick, I would love to know, what was the last movie that, like, truly scared you?
This one, when I was rewatching it.
Wow. I can't wait to learn. Can't wait to learn more about that.
So aside from the movie we're discussing.
Aside from that one. That's a good, because I know you were going to ask that, and I was kind of thinking, you know, okay, like, we have the usuals, like, Skinamarink. Let me tell you, when I saw Skinamarink on Shudder, I didn't have a bed at the moment because I was getting a new mattress, so I was sleeping on a air mattress in my living room when
really immersive. You had what they call an immersive experience.
Truly, truly. So that was a fun time, but I think Horror in the High Desert 2.
Okay.
And that one, I was not entirely sober when I watched it. Yeah. So there's a lot of plot that I didn't retain, but the scene, they're like in some kind of cluttered basement or something. I was like, I don't know what's happening. I'm so scared. I don't know what's happening. I'm so scared.
Dutch, fuck you. And I mean, end with love.
With love and respect.
With love and respect. Because I agree with you. Like, that is a movie. that I was lucky enough to also see in theaters with at Unnamed Footage Festival. And just, even though I'd already seen it, stress. Just stress. He's so good at just creating the scariest moments that make no sense and you're just kind of lost. So everybody, they're on Screambox if you haven't watched them. And also listen to our episode.
We need the third one.
I know. Are they doing a third one? I think, oh, there's going to be five. He's doing like a whole mythology. It's almost, I think it's almost done though, but I you didn't hear that from me.
Heard what?
Yeah.
Who?
I don't know what you're talking about.
How many cookies?
All right, Purpurina though, what movie have you brought with you today for us to discuss?
I brought the 1997 erupting disaster movie. No, not Dante's Peak. Volcano.
Volcano. In Volcano, a volcano, shockingly, erupts in downtown Los Angeles, and a city official, played by Tommy Lee Jones, and a seismologist, played by the late Anne Hesch.
Gorgeous Anne Hesch.
Oh, she's gorgeous. So hot. Trying to stop its inevitable flow through the city.
All right. This was a first watch for me.
Same.
And as well as Mary Beth, and I have to know, take us back. How old were you when you saw this? How did you see this? Why is this silly-ass movie your Scarred for Life pick?
So remember I talked about my dad watching whatever, yes, whenever. And I was a kid in the 90s. There was not a whole lot of keeping in mind kids around whenever anything was on TV for most people. I don't remember having seen the whole movie at once. It was really one scene that stuck with me. And it is the scene where John Carroll Lynch, he's one of the Metro supervisors. They have found
With a nicotine problem.
They have found... I might start crying as I'm talking about this. Just a heads up.
I'm sorry. I'm laughing because I thought it was so funny.
No, it is very funny, actually. Legitimately, I'm not being facetious. I cannot wait to talk to my therapist about this experience this week. which I have talked about my fear of volcanoes with her before, so it wouldn't be a surprise. So, John Carroll Lynch.
I'm so sorry.
Metro supervisor. These guys, you know, at this point in the movie, everybody's already responding to, you know, this volcano, this lava that's coming out in Los Angeles. And
from the La Brea Tar Pits.
From the La Brea Tar Pits, which I know in my frontal lobe, in my, you know, logical brain, that now geologically impossible. But when I was like maybe 10, when this would have been on TV, did not know that. There's a trapped Metro train, car, whatever, and they're down there, they're saving the people, and they gotta get the driver. He has passed out, and John Carroll Lynch goes and has to be a damn hero. My notes are literally like, "Stan, no," like in all caps. I also kept track of my heart rate while I was watching this. Like, I'm sitting down doing nothing while I'm watching it, and by the end of this scene, it was 115 when I watched this for this podcast. Okay, so I'm still.
What's your resting heart rate usually?
Way less than that, like significantly so, under 100 for sure. Okay, so I'm very reactive. So just for the listeners, if they have not seen the movie, he's doing the fireman carry, getting this driver out, and they're showing in agonizing detail his shoes are melting and
in slow motion
to the bottom of the car, and he starts praying Hail Mary, and like I started crying. Not when I was a kid. When I was a kid, I'm just watching this, probably like paralyzed in fear. So then he goes And he gets to the end and they're like, Stan, you're not going to make it. You're not going to make it. He
can't save him.
And he throws the driver who they're able to save. And Stan just goes and melts into the lava, which I also don't think is scientifically possible. But tell a 10-year-old that after watching it. And I just remember that scene, which, to be fair, a lot of the other stuff probably would have flew over 10-year-old me's head anyway. But there's a prologue to this.
All right.
I don't really think that much about that movie after that. Let's fast forward about 20 years. I have just moved to Los Angeles for graduate school. I live in a place where the part of the metro that makes the most sense to take is the Red Line. So that was the affected line in the movie.
Yep.
And I get on the Red Line with my friends and I'm kind of going like, why does this feel uniquely familiar in a weird way? Because, you know, there is not a lot of aesthetic updates to a metro line over time, especially in LA.
True.
And I, like, literally, like, Kill Bill sirens. Like, it just comes flooding back. And I was like, oh, my God. And I was immediately like, holy shit, that scene of Volcano. And I've always been afraid of Volcano. Even, like, the part in Fantasia where they go, like, through the earth, like, mm-hmm. you know, the part where the earth is all lava. I don't know if y'all have seen the Lord of the Rings TV show, but there's in one of the episodes.
Yeah, it's amazing.
There is a volcanic eruption. Oh my God. I literally physically I have a stomach of steel. I got nauseous watching that episode.
Hold on. was this movie the start of your fear of volcanoes? Like, where did the fear of volcanoes begin? Like, can we talk about that?
That's a good question. I think the fear started before and this just strengthened it. Because, like, when in the house that we lived in when I was a kid.
So this is your arachnophobia. Sorry. This is your arachnophobia.
Oh, fully.
Had it before, exacerbated it.
100%. Terry, the way you are with spider movies, like, I can deal with, like, some depictions of volcanoes, but if it keeps going, I'm like, I gotta look away. Like, I'm getting physically activated. It's like with any true phobia, we know it's irrational, right? That mm-hmm. doesn't stop the brain from responding the way it does.
Sure doesn't.
Because, like, in the backyard where we lived around that time, there was this little mound and I used to have nightmares of it growing up into a volcano. And like,
was this pre-volcano though, the movie?
I think it would have been pre-volcano, the movie. Yeah. And fun fact, later when I told my parents about that, they were like, oh yeah, we used to joke that was where the dead body was buried. I was like, that's cool. That's cool. Thanks for not telling that to us children back then, because that would have been wild.
So why, do you remember when you realized that you had a fear of volcanoes? Like, it seems like a very specific thing.
Yeah, it was one of those things that it always made sense to me to be afraid of volcanoes.
Okay, because they just sprout up everywhere, right?
every depiction of a volcano is, in a lot of media, especially of the time, is violent, or we're doing culturally insensitive depictions of people sacrificing things to volcanoes, or you know, it's and I do want to be, I know there are cultures where volcanoes are celebrated, so I don't want to be like they're bad, but and I don't believe that they're bad. Part of what scares me about them, especially now, is the indiscriminate. This is not a creature responding to something. This is not a person making a choice. This is just happening and ain't nothing you or anyone else can do about it. And like, no thanks.
Well, let me tell you, I am uniquely prepared for this episode because I have lived through a volcanic eruption.
What?
Yes. So,
my God,
as I've mentioned before, I grew up in Alaska the first, like, you know, 8 years of my life. And what happened in, let me see, where was it? 1989 in Alaska, Mount Redoubt exploded. And Mount Redoubt was like, how far? 110 miles southwest of Anchorage. And Anchorage is where is like, we live about 20 minutes outside of Anchorage. And so it erupted on December 14th of 1989 and continued to, I think, erupt for about 6 months. And we were far enough away that, like, there was nothing except ash. And ash would just coat the snow. And so the whole thing is, everyone has jokes, don't eat the yellow snow. For us in Alaska this year, it was don't eat the gray snow, because it was literally coating the snow in ash. And so I would have been 8 years old at the time, not thinking anything of it. We lived through earthquakes. Earthquakes happen a lot in Alaska. So we had earthquakes all the time. And then this happened when I was 8 years old. So I am uniquely qualified to talk about this movie.
I think my heart has not restarted since you started talking about that. Like,
I'm literally shaking like I right know, now. I feel like I know so much about you, Terry, and then you shock me with this story, and I'm like, I don't know this man at all.
Well, and what really fucks me up about it, like, I also have a great fear of moose, and you have fucking moose stories, too. Like, what the hell, Terry? We sure do.
The moose that stuck its head in our window. Yeah.
Fabrina, I love that you grew up in Texas, and you're scared of volcanoes and moose.
The moose thing
is... I get it. Look, it's not judgmental, because I have similar stories about being afraid of things that were not where I grew up. I get it. It's just very funny, like, to hear. You lived in a place that had very real things to be afraid of, and you were afraid of things that are not around you.
Well, and...
Which, again, makes sense.
So, one, sorry. Briefly, the moose thing is more recent. I saw... For the first time in my life, as an adult, I saw a picture that really showed them to scale, and that just
they're huge.
Viscerally stirred something within my soul that went, no, thank you.
It's like behemoth, like cosmic horror type vibes. You're like, no, that is an unreasonably large creature that I need to respect as if it is a god.
They shouldn't be allowed. I'm not okay with them. And I hope they don't hear that and fight me.
That was perfect timing. Listeners, just taking a drink. And now I think the drink is either up her nose or somewhere in the room or both. Unsure.
I'm sorry.
That was a beautiful thing.
But, I mean, no, it's funny that you point that out, Mary Beth, because I think that's a very real part of it, where it's like when you actually experience things, that demystifies them. Right? Yeah. Like, mm-hmm. A rattlesnake, you just gotta not go there. leave it alone. Okay. You know, like, all that kind of, you know, heat stroke, go inside and drink some water. You know, like, it's...
Not to stoke the fear, but I put in chat a picture of what it looked like in 1990.
Oh, God.
Mount Redoubt.
See, so the picture is like the cloud of ash, mm-hmm. coming out of the volcano. That I'm okay with. It looks like I've been watching a lot of old 50s big monster movies lately. So I've been seeing a lot of like radiation nuke stuff, and that looks like a mushroom cloud almost.
It does, absolutely.
Yeah. But
yeah, that was in April of 1990.
Jeez.
So to go back to Volcano the movie, thought that this was Joe versus the Volcano, because I thought Volcano and Joe versus the Volcano were the same movie, everybody.
Amazing.
The Tom Hanks movie.
Talk about sacrifice.
Yeah, where Tom Hanks plays a guy who's dying and someone offers him a way to die with dignity, aka throwing himself into a volcano. So I was like, why is Purpurina so scared of the Volcano? Like, I don't understand. I get it now. I get it now. I thought that Joe versus the Volcano for some reason was like the only volcano movie. Dante's Peak, I also thought it was Joe versus the Volcano. I literally thought all of these movies were the same movie.
I love that. You're this entire time, you're like, I don't know why people talk about this comedy the way that they do.
Well, but I also didn't remember being a comedy. I don't understand why I conflated all three like popular volcano-centric films into one. Because I know they're all relative. Well, Steve was funny because Steve was like, oh, we were watching Volcano. Is that the one with Pierce Brosnan as the hot scientist who saves the day? Or is it the one with the grumpy old man who saves the day? And I said, it's the grumpy old man who saves the day. Tommy Lee Jones as like the very stern man who like knows how to command a team of construction men, but like.
Who is from the Midwest. Is new enough to LA that people still rib him for being from the Midwest and yet knows the city like the back of his fucking hand.
Oh, I have a very new appreciation for his character on this rewatch because, like, I really appreciated how they... Like, even from the beginning, like, his quick thinking on his toes when he drops the scrambled eggs and then he says cornflakes for breakfast instead of getting mad and getting caught up in, oh, I dropped the eggs. Like, mm-hmm. like we're seeing that, like, yeah, there's a reason why he's good at his job, why, you know, he's so committed to his job. Can I also say something about Tommy Lee Jones?
Yes, please.
Every time I see him, I get homesick. Like, anytime I watch a movie, there is something about the cadence and his delivery that is so very Texan that I'm like,
okay,
I want to go back.
He also just, like, has always looked old, Tommy Lee Jones. Yeah. You know, he's just always looked like
a grumpy old man.
Old guy, grumpy old guy. Very curmudgeonly, but well-meaning.
He came out like that. Yeah.
But it's, like, incredible because as we mentioned in the synopsis, it's him and then Anne Hesh and him. It's like they pair up, but like not romantically. They're just like, it's like that's incredible. This movie is so fucking silly, but the relationship between Anne Hesh and Tommy Lee Jones in this movie is actually kind of incredible. And actually, Tommy Lee Jones has like an incredible relationship with several women in this movie. And I'm like, wait, this is actually very, like a lot of incredibly strong women in this film that like aren't just romantic interests or like titties. You know what I mean? Like that's very rare for that era of movie of this ilk. And so it is rather refreshing, even though it is obviously a very silly movie.
Yeah.
What I do appreciate about this film is that I was like, okay, he has an ex-wife. Is she across town and he's going to have to go save her? Was my first question, because like that always happens in these types of movies, right? Even up to Cloverfield, where he's in love with someone and he has to go across the city to save her. Is that what's going to happen here? No. And I was like, oh, are we teaming up this 51-year-old with a 28-year-old in a romantic way? Because, you know, in Hollywood, we always have to have the old man and the younger woman because why? And I was like, is that what's going to happen here? No. Thank goodness. Mm-hmm. The only like kind of stereotypical moment is the fact that there is his daughter in trouble and she always seems to be at the epicenter of disaster. And so that is the only moment that from the character perspective that I was like, okay, that's a trope. But all the other ones that were big in my mind, sidestepped, impressed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I will admit a lot of my notes are like, I could lose the nagging wife, I could lose, or ex-wife, I could lose the kid plot. Although I understand the importance of the responsibility and that theme. But I was like, I think also part of what loses it for me is she was supposed to be 13 being played by a 15-year-old, which those 2 years developmentally is a lot. Mentally, emotionally, and fit, like all of it is a big difference between those 2 years.
5 minutes in the movie, I was literally Googling to find out how old Gabby was at this time, because I was like, there's no way that girl is 13. 15, I could understand, which does not, again, 2 years does not seem that much, but we're not talking about a 30-year-old and a 28-year-old. We're talking about someone that is a preteen and a teen.
Yeah.
And I was like, there is no way she is 13 years old.
Yeah. Yeah. That definitely took me out a little bit. Cause then she's like holding her little stuffed animal. And I'm kind of like, Like, not that 15-year-olds can't have stuffed animals. Oh my god,
wait, that's so funny. I just realized, I didn't realize that she was 13. I thought she was just a really weird teenager.
Mary Beth's like, I thought she was just like that.
I legitimately thought, I didn't realize. That is just a character trait. I literally thought that she was just, like, really sad because her parents were divorced, so she was just, like, emotionally stunted.
13 years old.
Ooh, boy.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't break the movie for me, but, like, in those scenes, I'm like, yeah, okay, oh, yeah, let's
just, I was just like, oh, she's just another weird-ass kid in Hollywood. They didn't know what a child was like, so they made Gabby Hoffman act, like, six different age ranges all at once to make us feel bad for her. Also, Gabby Hoffman in this as a teenager is wild. I forgot that Gabby Hoffman, was a teenage child actor.
Yeah, same. I was like, I looked at her as like, why does she look so familiar? And then I went, oh shit, that is Gabby. I had no idea that she ever was that young.
Also, just seeing Tommy Lee Jones as the father to a 13-year-old/15-year-old is very funny because I'm sorry, he looks like a grandpa. And everyone treats him like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. This movie is like, because this is directed also by the people who did Threads, which Director we covered on this Threads. Podcast. And Threads is absolutely fucking disturbing, horrible.
Gritty, down to earth.
Except for the end gets a little... The way that Threads ends
makes... The end jumps the shark.
The end jumps the shark in Threads, which I think makes sense for why Volcano is what it is. But, like, Threads is this, like... really down-to-earth, fucked-up look at what would happen if there was a nuclear bomb dropped in the UK. And, like, what life would look like for people and, like, physically. And, like, all this, like, horrific shit. Like, it's just disturbing.
Are you saying that Volcano is not an accurate depiction of what would happen should a volcano erupt in LA? Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, actually, that's exactly. And so it's just, like, very funny to see that I think they... Okay, here's the problem. I think they tried to make it realistic, but, like, the budget and resources that they had access to did not support, I think, what the vision was.
I mean, this was an expensive movie.
And this is not to shame, I know that this, like, scares you, and, like, this is not to, like, diminish at all, like, your reactions to it. I think just because I'd never seen it and watching it in, like, my context, it's just, like, it's not bad necessarily, but, like, some of the stuff looks like action figures being thrown out of things, and, like, you know what I mean? Like, there's some silliness to it in terms of how they execute the visuals. Like, at one point, they just focus on a shot of a Jack Russell Terrier barking at some pretty bad CGI lava oozing through a house, and he grabs his bone and runs out of the house to his owner. Admittedly, incredible, but, like, what?
So,
why?
I have a couple of things. One... Okay. So with arachnophobes, studies show that they perceive spiders to be larger than they actually are.
Yeah, that's because they are giant.
I think I have a similar thing with CGI lava.
Okay.
Where, like, obviously, if I'm looking at, like, N64 graphics, that's not going to mess me up. I also hate being hot. Like, I'm a person that runs hot, and I hate... being Same. Physically hot. So Same. Seeing that, thinking about how hot it must be, like, adds to the discomfort in watching. But, like, yeah, like, it was when it, like, you're talking about, like, the bad CGI lava, like, with the dog, and my notes are all caps, Bill, no, run away, Bill the dog, like just freaking out.
Meanwhile, I'm like, okay.
But the other thing... One thing that the movie gets wrong about what the response would be in LA is LA would be far less organized in its response.
Okay. This movie is very pro local government. This movie is very pro local government. And I'm like, we have proof through Katrina and other natural disasters that this is not how we would be responding.
Well, and I did want to talk about the sociopolitical themes and aspects of this, because the first time I rewatched this was actually during the George Floyd protests. And so for listener context, this movie came out 5 or 6 years after Rodney King and what they call the LA riots. Mary Beth and I
were just talking about this right before you popped on.
Yeah. Yeah, and so there's a lot of, like, the more things change, the more they stay the same. Even literally, you know how they have the protest against the Metro and the Beverly Center? To this day, protest has not been built because we can't have the poors coming here on the public transportation.
So, okay, I do... There's so many things I want to ping off of on that. The first thing is that I started watching this early, and then I had a TV get delivered, and so I stopped watching it, and then my roommate was like, ooh, I want to watch Volcano, so I started it from the beginning again. So I had seen, like, the first 8 minutes, and then I, you know, went back. And on the second watch, I realized that this protest in the beginning, that they literally talk about how, where was it? They're talking about how the people that want this never voted for a subway. And mm-hmm. the implication, because they are Mexican-American, the implication is that they are illegal immigrants. And so that moment right there, I was on the second watch, I was like, holy shit, these people.
And there are things that are clumsy, but there are things that I really appreciate about what the movie's trying to do. Like, for example, we see the extreme response, emergency response to the shops at Beverly Hills, where yeah. they're talking about a block over, here's a community of predominantly Black individuals, and they're letting the houses burn. That's where Bill was, man. I'm so glad Bill made it to his owner. Spoilers. but like, and both of the dogs survive. Actually, we got to see Bill and we got to see Max come back. No dog deaths.
That's true.
But like that, they really there's a lot of obvious telling of some of this stuff, but there was also a lot of showing that disparity and how, of course, we're gonna save these shops that are all empty at that point, while you see these people trying to use garden hoses to save their houses from the eruption.
There's some interesting visual storytelling going on here. It's not like, hey, look at me, or hey, look at this. It is just happening in a very interesting way. And then we have a little kid literally saying, look at their faces. They're all the same because everyone is covered in ash and you can't tell their skin color. And I was like, wait, did this volcano solve the race problem in America? Is that what we're saying?
Didn't you know that when there's a natural disaster, we can all come together as a society and really fix things? Like, Hurricane Katrina really showed how great we are as a society at uniting to help rescue people in poor neighborhoods.
It solved racism, movie.
Yeah. Didn't you see how that one cop's racism got cured, even though he couldn't barely look the Black man in the face after he helped him out? Like, but... You're a good... The cop's name was Terry. The other cop claps him on the back and goes, You're a good man,
come
Terry.
On. Come on! This movie's gunning for me.
Meanwhile, Don Cheadle wearing a really weird hat, and he's just, like, executing everything from afar on the phone, and it's just, like...
Okay, but can we appreciate the dialogue that they gave Cheadle and, like, the quick wit of that character? And, like, he was the glue of the emergency response, truly. Like, Tommy Lee Jones might have been in charge, but Don Cheadle was the one back there babysitting everybody else and aligning everything together.
I really love this movie, huh?
I really, like, I have seen it as an adult only twice, but, like, I took a lot of notes.
It is a very sincere yet silly take on the disaster movie. Like, and I appreciate what it's trying to do, but it comes off comparatively to, like, other disaster films that I've seen. It's like a little cheesy. I don't know if anyone else feels similarly to, like, how it comes off. I don't think it means to, but I think it's, like,
My feeling was that, like, it got in its own way. Whenever it had a moment where it could, like, breathe in some of the drama, they did something that immediately undercut it. As an example, the part where Anne Heche's colleague gets killed, and she is... I'm laughing because of what I'm building to. She is mourning her friend who just died, and that they are right about this being a volcano. And she puts her gas tank on the hood of the truck, and there's looters stealing stuff. And while she's like mourning, and it's centered on her, kind of like with this real sad face, one of the looters steals her gas tank from right behind her. Which is hilarious, but doesn't let her have that moment.
It does not.
And so, wow. Okay. One of the things that surprised the heck out of me is that this was co-written by a man named Billy Ray, who would go on to write Captain Phillips, The Hunger Games, Shattered Glass, Terminator Dark Fate, Overlord. Got to start here, kind of.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying this is a 5 out of 5 movie by any means, but like, I think it's like, I can see some of the pieces where I'm like, oh, I wish you had let that breathe, or I wish you had done something different. And then also there's just the fact that I'm gonna be terrified by some of this stuff. Even going back to the scene with poor Stan, one of the things that really, like, on this rewatch, I immediately burst into tears when he started praying. Not because I still believe. I had the same thing with Midnight Mass, where there's just something about being raised Catholic that, like, having that almost cultural connection and seeing how, knowing how big of a deal some of these movements and these prayers are, to see him, like, trying to save this man, you know, now and in the hour of our death. And I'm like, oh my God. You know, just like losing it. Yeah.
Meanwhile, I'm sitting here going, man, this is a really religious film, because the idea of, like, religion comes up a whole lot in here. We have at the very beginning of the movie, we have with, so side note, that is one thing that I did appreciate of from the director, Mick Jackson, who also did Threads, is that the way this movie start felt like we were doing a slice of life of LA, where, you know, we see all the, it's the 90s, so all the health fads, and we got all these commercials, and we're hearing about news reports and everything. It felt very slice of life in the way that Threads started. But we also have this fire and brimstone minister on TV talking about, you know, how the devil is, who's portrayed as very warm, you know, is here and yada yada yada. I'm like, okay, so we're starting off with that, and we're ending with Tommy Lee Jones reciting some passage from the Bible about houses built on sand. So we have that. We have this moment of sacrifice, of involving Stan giving himself up very Christ-like to throw, you know, the conductor from it while he's praying. Like, there's all this moment. I was like, religion is threaded through this. Almost as much as the fact that it is saying that local government will save you.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I wonder if I didn't pick up as much on the religion because I, not so much like living in LA, because like whatever, like just like seeing those different facets of being part of like the landscape that is here, like, and people have assumptions about California, especially Southern California, you know, everybody's super liberal. No. Right. Like, you know, like, right. We truly right. have all types. And so, like, that, like, I feel like I kind of perceive that as, like, oh, yeah, like, they're showing our all types. But I think you're also absolutely right that there is this, somebody will save you. Don't worry about, you know, the disaster. Like, there are people in charge who know what they're doing. And if they don't know, they're going to figure it out.
Or they're going to sacrifice themselves. How many people sacrifice themselves for the good of others? The bomb person in the towards the very end, and Gator, who's there with him, and Gator could have left. Like, I get the guy that was trapped under the debris couldn't, but Gator could have left. But he's like, no, we're going to both die here together to it save. It feels
very brothers in arms. Right. Yeah. Like, you know, don't leave a man behind, you know, and this is purely coincidence because I've been reading it before we talked about me coming on, but I've been reading this book called The Unthinkable: Who Survives When Disaster Strikes and Why? And they're talking a lot about, I mean, also disasters and stuff in the wilderness is one of my like special interests, but like this is not in the wilderness. This is more kind of things like this where there's a lot of people. Why do some people freeze? Why do some people engage in heroism? All that kind of stuff. And it like, it's one of those things where, yeah, we are going to see all those different things, but like, I think you're right. Not to the degree that the movie is portraying.
Right. Well, I think it's because all the people that either are sacrificing themselves are people of, you know, the government, whether it's the metro worker, whether it is Tommy Lee Jones's profession, whether it is the bomb squad. Like, these are all, you know, state employees typically that are giving themselves up for the good of the city. I don't think that's what's going to happen.
I mean, he was even giving up his PTO when it was just a regular earthquake, right?
Girl, I'm not giving up my PTO.
My work phone is off.
Don Cheadle had that shit. Don Cheadle had that shit.
Yeah, yeah.
I sleep on your desk, boss. I live and breathe disasters.
That was so funny to me. Because, like, I think there's really something about, like, kind of the gallows humor sarcasm that absolutely would come up in a setting like that, that felt very natural to me about how they talk to one another. Not just Cheadle and Tommy Lee Jones, but, like, everyone in that office. You know, there was the one that he told the guy, like, when he made fun of his hat, like, oh, yeah, your wife told me the same thing. You know, like, kind of just that.
The good-natured ribbing and the, yeah. So... I'm curious. I want to go back to a point that you were talking about, Mary Beth, where you kind of were not expecting this to be as silly. And I think what's interesting is that both in 1997 and then I believe again in 1998, we had two movies of about the same subject coming out within months of each other, and one being praise that was like more, I mean, I don't even know, this movie was not praise, so I take that kind of back. But like the idea of like this big blockbuster movie that is like big crowd pleaser and then a more intimate film. So like we have here, we have Volcano that was preceded very briefly by Dante's Peak. And then in 1998, we would have Armageddon and Deep Impact. And it's interesting to me that these two movies came out very similar time. It was almost like, you know, they're trying to beat the other one to the punch of making the Volcano movie. Disaster films were really big getting into the 90s with, we started off with Alive, and then we had Independence Day. We have this, we have Armageddon, we have like White Squall. So like nature, us versus nature was like a big theme into the 90s. But I never saw this movie because I saw Dante's Peak and I thought this movie looked really silly, and I really enjoyed Dante's Peak. Have you ever seen Dante's Peak, either of you?
Mm-hmm.
I like Dante's Peak a lot.
I would have to re-watch it, but I did watch it a few years ago at my friend's house, and I remember being like, I'm going to play with your toddler during some of the scenes. Like, I'm going Mary to Beth, look away right now.
There is a scene in Dante's Peak where the grandmother of the family, that they have to go rescue her because she's strong-willed and doesn't want to leave.
Oh, I've seen that. I've seen that scene. I have seen that scene before.
Walking through the acid lake, pulling the canoe.
Yep. And that doesn't fuck me up to watch as much as Stan. Like, it's still harrowing, don't get me wrong. It's not, I'm not having fun watching Nana do her thing. But like, like that I can watch with a stronger stomach compared to, there's something about the chaos of lava that, no thanks.
So... One last thing. I do want to talk about the chaos of lava, because there was a line here that I took a note on and I bolded it because I was cackling at it. We're dealing with very determined stuff here, as if the lava has intentionality. And I was thinking, wait, is this a 90s remake of The Blob?
Ooh.
Because it is literally moving almost as if the blob is coming through the town. They say it's very determined. It is hot. Cold stops it. Like, this is all, like, I'm sitting here going, wait, are they saying that this lava is actually alive? Is this a blob movie?
Would you have been happier if it turned into a magma blob story?
Yes. Absolutely.
I mean, that kind of slaps and I kind of want to write it. Like...
Yeah.
I will be crying the entire time I'm researching and writing it. But like...
I think it's a great idea.
Yeah. No, I mean, and I think that's part of it too, right? Like, I don't know if it's just movies like this, but like, we do want to treat these natural functions as though they have intentionality, as though they have, they can make the choice to go through the tar pits or not, right? Like, which I've also been to the tar pits and it was fine because this cannot happen in real life. geologically, a geologist will be like, no, volcano. That's not what happens in that kind of space.
Before we recorded, you said you'd seen the tar pits too, right, Mary Beth?
Oh, yeah. I was like so excited to see them. I like thought they, my parents moved to Southern California. I got to go to LA for the first time because I was like, oh my God, I get to go to LA. I'm like, I want to see the La Brea tar pits. For some, I don't know why I wanted to see them. I cannot remember for the life of me, like, what I thought it was, but we got there and it was just like stinky. Mm-hmm.
Like, we're at a tar pit.
Statues just like stuck in tar and it was just bubbling. I was like, I don't really know what I expected, but this is actually quite bizarre. Like, this is just like a landmark in California, in Los Angeles. It's just bubbling pits of tar. Like, what the hell?
Wait, did you go to the actual museum?
Yeah.
Okay. I thought you were saying they all just stood outside.
Well, that was like, mostly what we did, but like, I mean, like, yeah, I know it's a whole museum, but it's still wild that they're like, that's a it's like a mud pit, essentially, is what it, and it's just like a stinky pit. I just find, and it makes sense that they would have a volcano come out of the stinky pit in the middle of LA. Like, it obviously is like in a very like logistically in your head without thinking about how nature works. I get it, but it's just very funny, the shot of like lava coming out and just like the statues that are in it just sinking into the ground. Like, it looks all dramatic. And I'm like, that's just like the plastic statue that they put in there to make it look all dramatic. And I don't know why, it just makes me laugh.
Really quick, speaking of the museum, so there's the Tar Pit Museum and then there's also an art museum. And in the film, we see them saving the paintings. And I laugh so hard. It's the dumbest joke, but I laughed so hard when he was like, man, this Hieronymus Bosch is really heavy. And he was like, well, you know, he deals with the sins of man. And like he has like a whole again, long like
thing again about religion.
But also just like, and obviously like, you know what you're doing when you write in a line about Hieronymus Bosch into your volcano disaster movie. Like, come
Moses
on.
Couldn't part the sea. This sea is another line that is spoken in here.
Yeah, that's fair. Well, and I think there's also something about, like, in media in general, American media, I want to say, in American media in general, how often do we incorporate, like, Christ figures and, like, other biblical references, assuming that everyone would understand that shorthand? Like, one of my friends is Muslim, and, like, you know, there was one time we were talking about, I was like, yeah, you know, is this, that, whatever, and I mentioned, you know, in this movie, blah, blah, blah. She goes, I didn't even catch that. And I was like, oh, yeah, because you did not go to the mass every Sunday, like, you were doing something else, you know, like, and...
I mean, the idea of sacrifice in Christ is, like, a big story point in cinema in the Americas. I mean, even, like, The Matrix is... there's a Christ-like, you know, idea behind it. So, like, it does make sense in some regards that we use that as, like, a cultural touchstone for shorthand for what we're doing here. It's just kind of silly to me in this particular movie how heavy-handed it is.
Well, and I'm agreeing with that criticism because it's like, yeah, why do we default to the Christian shorthand for these things? Like, what if we left it out? Or wouldn't it be interesting if we used a different spiritual framework, you know, to explore these things? Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's, I don't know. There's like a lot of, there was a lot of jokes that I'm like, that's silly. And I'm laughing, but it's not hard to please me, to be honest.
You have the built-in fear of the volcano, I think. Again, like, arachnophobia is silly to me, but to Terry, it's terrifying, you know? Like, I get it, because the context for you is different. And you know, I'm glad I watched it. I think it's a silly, good disaster movie.
One shot that I really liked is when they put the camera down to see what was going on, if the lava was coming through. And so we didn't get quite a Paranormal Activity 3 of, like, the first view of the camera. But what I really liked was, like, everything's blue and dark. And you see the camera and you see the reflection of the red on the camera before they show us the fire and the lava. I really appreciated that beat.
Yeah.
And again, it's funny. Before we just wrap up, it just feels like it not as high of a budget of a movie to me, even though I know it was an expensive movie. It's very interesting.
It was an expensive movie that came out in 1997. So,
you know. Yeah, true.
Limitations true. Of the time. True.
All right, Terry, let's wrap this up and give us our rating out of 5. So first off to you, Terry, how many volcanic La Brea tar pits out of 5 do you give Volcano?
I mean, this movie, there's so much in this movie that I don't honestly know how to answer that, because we go from some really, there's some striking images in here. I do love the moments of there's some dread in terms of, there's that moment when Tommy Lee Jones and his daughter are in the car and the steam is bursting out of the manholes and then fireballs start raining. Like, there's some really well executed moments in here. And then we have a kid saying, "They all are the same, covered in ash."
That's the thing. It blows up its shit with that. I'm sorry.
No, agreed. Just like, agreed.
There's some really great moments in this. And then there's like moments that I'm just like, how did this get made? And so I don't really know how to really rate that, because did I have fun? Yes, I had a lot of fun. Is this a movie I'm going to go watch again? No, I'd much rather go watch Dante's Peak, which I did make as a double feature, because I was like, why the fuck not? I'm going to watch Dante's Peak. Dante's Peak, I still find very harrowing. Silly, but harrowing. This movie, it's fun. It's a good popcorn movie. I do appreciate, by the way, that this movie was under 2 hours long. Can you imagine if they made this movie today? It'd be like a 3-hour epic. Like, it doesn't need to be like that. So I was appreciative that it did not waste our time, that it was in, out, disaster started. We're not like making a big fucking epic that films are today. It's fun. I'm going to give it 3.5 volcanic La Brea tar pits for myself. What about you, Mary Beth?
I'm going to have to give it 3 volcanic La Brea tar pits. I enjoyed it for what it was. It was a fun disaster movie watch. I definitely think there was some parts that were just very silly, a little campy, because I think it is sincere in what it's trying to do, but the execution is just, it becomes campy in terms of like, I don't know how to describe it, but I wish they had used Anne Hatch a little bit more. But, you know, what can you do? I think she's underutilized in this movie. I absolutely love the scene where the volcano happens and her scientist friend gets eaten by the volcano. That is some horror movie shit, that scene. There's just a giant chasm. So, I mean, like, it's silly, but I enjoyed it, so it's 3. Papriana, you have the final word. How many volcanic La Brea tar pits out of 5 do you give?
Terry, I find it very funny that you called out the runtime, because it did take me over 2 hours to watch it because I was pausing to regulate myself. Like, literally after the stand scene, I had to pause it for so long that the Apple TV turned off.
Okay, that's hilarious.
And it's fully like, I would never expect anybody else to react the way that I do to this movie. Let me make that clear. Like, I'm not saying, how are y'all not messed up by... No. That said, I'm here for camp and silly. I did appreciate a lot of the stuff that I did find funny, whether they intended it or not. It was helpful so that I wasn't just constantly sweating. Mm-hmm. I was so tense during the stand scene that the tops of my boobs got sore. Do you know how hard you have to clench all the muscles in your body for that to happen over, how long is that scene? Probably not even 10 minutes. I don't know.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
I think I'm going to have to, but also, like, there are very fair criticisms, and I very much agree with a lot of the points y'all brought up, so I think I'm going to be with Terry and give it 3.5 Liberated Tar Pit Eruptions.
I just want to read my note on the Stan death. Stan jumps into the lava to save him. He's on fire, and he literally throws the conductor onto safety before melting like the Wicked Witch.
Can I read you my notes?
Yes.
Okay, let's do this. Heart rate currently 101 at time of unpausing. I am sweating. Not the music in the slow motion. The melting shoes. This entire scene is seared into my brain. The prayer, God, God, God. Jump Stan, his face, their faces. I'm crying. No, I'm sobbing. God, the way he just fucking goes down. Pausing again. Heart rate 115.
And then he melted like the Wicked Witch.
Yeah, it really is like that. If I was to pick a singular still, it would be him, like, looking head on, like going down into the lava is the still that etched. When I die, that's going to be part of what flashes in front of my eyes. Like,
this movie will be your life flashback. Well, thank you so much, Purpurina, for joining us, reliving your pain and talking about Volcano. Where can listeners find you? And the floor is yours to plug away.
First, thank you both so much for having me. This has been so much fun. First, I'm going to plug Observable Radio. You can find us just about anywhere at Observable Radio. Our website is also observableradio.com. We release episodes every last Tuesday of the month. So at the time of this recording, we're recording on January 30th. We just released our 6th episode. Patreon subscribers get our ad-free episode a few days early. So if you don't like ads, and if you like doing Patreons, we're on there too. You can follow me just about anywhere at Purpurina Stitch. That is P-U-R-P-U-R-I-N-A Stitch. And I mostly post stitches and random little thoughts about different movies and such. And yeah.
Hell yeah. All right, listeners, you've heard from us. We want to hear from you. What was your experience with Volcano or Dante's Peak or Joe versus the Volcano that I all thought they were? You can send us an email.
Wait, have you seen Joe versus the Volcano?
Me?
Yeah.
Yeah, I have.
Okay. That's the one I've not seen.
Long, long ago. So I remember nothing from it. But yeah, send us an email at scarredforlifepodcast@gmail.com, or you can reach out to us on social media. I am at mbmcandrews on Twitter and at mb.mcandrews on Instagram.
And I'm at Gaily Dreadful everywhere.
And of course, don't forget to follow the podcast on Instagram at scarredforlifepodcast and on Twitter and Blue Sky at scarredpodcast.
And please don't forget to review, rate, and subscribe. And if you want to help support us, we do have a Patreon.
Ooh, thank you, Eric Power. Thank you to Eric Bauer for our artwork. Thank you to Sean Keller for our music. Thank you everyone for listening. Please stay safe out there, but most importantly, stay creepy.
And until next time.